Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I am the Bill Arnold part of that sentence. We have a great show coming up for you today. Genevieve Wood, a senior contributor from the Daily Signal, is going to be joining us in just a minute. And then my friend Bob Solheim is going to be with us as well from NC Little Hospice in Edina, Minnesota. It's an 8-bed hospice home where people obviously go to spend their last days on this earth. And we're going to talk to him about that phase of life. And if you're a boomer, maybe you've gone through it already with parents. And it's a interesting subject we'll address in the second part of the hour. I saw that Saddleback Church celebrated 50,000 baptisms. A spokesman said, too, they now absolutely have to change the water and clean the baptismal. But that's a great story. So we've got a great show coming up. I'm going to take a little break and then get Genevieve Wood on. What a fun name to say. She's going to be pinch-hitting for Rob Bluey from the Daily Signal today because Rob's on vacation with his family, as you may know. But he'll be back in a week or so. But Genevieve is absolutely fantastic. So we'll take a short break and be joined by Genevieve Wood in just a minute.
Hi, this is Dick Whitmer, station manager of Faith Radio. Within a few days, you'll be receiving a letter from me about Faith Radio's fall fundraiser known as Share. I do hope you will take a few moments to read the letter and then pray for this ministry. Faith Radio is making a difference for Christ in the Upper Midwest thanks to you. Relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching happens because of friends like you standing with this ministry. Your prayers and generous ongoing monthly support is the backbone to this ministry, and we do say thank you. Thank you again for joining the team that keeps Faith Radio going and growing. We believe God will be glorified and lives will be changed because of your kindness. Please visit our website today to give a gift or to start your ongoing monthly pledge. Our website is myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Thank you again and God bless you.
Welcome back to the show. Awfully glad you're with me today. Genevieve Wood is a senior contributor of the Daily Signal. And like other of her colleagues, Rob Bluey, Jarrett Stepman, and many others, one of the requirements to work at the Daily Signal is you need to have a cool name. And she certainly fits that bill. She's with us today. Hello, Genevieve.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much. Well, it looks like we finally got a date on the calendar for the confirmation hearings to get officially underway for Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, that's right. The day after Labor Day, people are not going to be able to straggle back into town. They're going to have to be not only in their seats, but prepared to get the hearings going. This just was announced last week by the Judiciary Committee chairman. You have a lot of those on the left who I think aren't happy about it. They were hoping to continue kind of dragging their feet and just requesting more documents.
Mm-hmm.
But Senator Grassley's like, you can request all the documents you want, but I hope you'll get them read by September 4th because we're going to get started on this.
Wow, I bet they're irritated for more than one reason. I mean, just the fact you've got to be back in your chair promptly on Tuesday morning after a nice holiday weekend is probably a little annoying to a lot of people as it is.
Well, especially the Senate, who
right.
is already coming back to Washington this week. They're not getting the full August recess that they're used to because Senator Mitch McConnell's like, we've got work to get done, and we're not just going to be back in our districts. We've got to be here actually doing what we already told people we were going to do, not there making new promises. So they're already coming back to town this week, and which will make the Labor Day weekend even shorter, but this is what we pay them for.
Exactly. Genevieve, would you help talk me through this Peter Strzok thing? I mean, this whole thing just seems to be such a catastrophic mess. I mean, he was in charge of getting Hillary Clinton's status downgraded from what was the original charge for her criminal negligence? It wasn't that, but it went to extreme carelessness. What
exactly.
What should it have
well,
been?
I mean, they I think they tried. try to change it from more criminal behavior to a lesser offense, if you will. And much of that, what I think, honestly, was a PR campaign, right? Forget just what would actually have happened in a courtroom had she ever been asked to go into one. I think a lot of this was trying to notch it down in the public's view in terms of how serious a breach this might have been. Mm-hmm. So I think, and from the get-go, I think that was a big push on his side. Look, I mean, this is somebody who, it's not just a Hillary Clinton email investigation. That was certainly number one. But number two, you have to look at what he was doing, looking into the quote-unquote problem with Russia and the Trump campaign,
right,
which many would question did that even exist. And the, you know, the, everybody has an opinion, including FBI agents, and we all have the right to a personal opinion. Political folks who work in political office or those who are in law enforcement, they get to vote for their choice for president or member of Congress just like the rest of us. The problem for Mr. Strzok is that he decided to come out publicly and make it very clear what his opinion was, and he used government resources to do it. He was using a government phone, mm-hmm, a government computer, and so it just makes it very unlikely that the public could have any true faith that someone who was that adamant about his beliefs against President, well, at that time, candidate Trump, and who was so adamant that Hillary Clinton had done nothing wrong, that you were really going to get fair investigations in either of those cases. I think he should have recused himself from day one, and he'd probably still have a job today.
I bet so. Now he's been officially fired, and an online fund supporting, they raised $250,000 on one day.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Pretty amazing. Well, I guess, you know, most of the folks, I think, giving money to that are probably people who don't like President Trump, and this is almost like giving to the Democratic Party in their view, and giving to a campaign. So any money going to him, I guess, maybe isn't going to a Democratic candidate running somewhere. So maybe one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Genevieve, how is this going to affect the ongoing investigation with Robert Mueller?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think we know for sure yet. I think what we do know is, again, when you look at how this is playing out, he's not the first member of the FBI team here who's either been fired or been asked to step down or had to resign. I mean, that's in and of itself, if you're the public, you have to start questioning, why are all these folks having to resign or why are they getting fired if they're the ones actually running the investigation? I think that it's damaging, I think, for the Mueller campaign, but we'll see how he plays his hand with it.
Did you watch any of the Peter Strzok hearing? Did you see any of that? What was your thoughts?
I saw parts of it.
Yeah, that's about all I could stomach was parts of it. What did you think of his attitude and his approach at the hearing?
Well, I thought he was very flippant. He didn't seem to have much respect for the congressional body that had actually asked him to come in and to testify. And to me, that's a disrespect to the people because, I mean, Congress is there and that's one of their duties is to play check on other branches of the government. They had every right to bring him in and ask the questions that they were asking. And he just seemed very disrespectful of the entire process and certainly didn't admit to, in his view, having done anything wrong. So, you know, again, I don't think it plays on to the sympathies of most people who would have an open mind, except for those who, again, they want to see the president either impeached or dragged into court. And so they liked his behavior probably, but I thought it was disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. When I think of the word budget fight, I mean, those words always seem to go together, don't they?
Yeah.
Whether it should go together. Yeah, whether it's even a government or even just a household. I mean, budgets are contentious issues. Now, is it a smart idea, Genevieve, to do this before the election?
I think so, because it allows people to then vote based on some of what happened, as opposed to what often happens in an election cycle is you have Congress kick most of the big budget decisions to after the election. And the problem with that is you end up having people vote who may have just been voted out of office, or maybe they retiring at the end of their term, and yet they're coming back to town in November and December and making decisions when they're no longer going to be held. People couldn't hold them accountable at that point. So I do think it's good to have it done before the election. That said, you know, one of the challenges that Congress has faced over many of the recent years is not, you know, not doing individual budgets. In other words, not looking at just the Health and Human Services budget or just the Department of Education budget or the Department of Defense. They've kind of rolled everything up into one because they didn't do them individually and passed one big bill. To the Republicans' credit and the fact that they lead the House and the Senate right now, they have been doing more of the one-off budgets, meaning let's just look at the Department of Defense. Let's just look at Department of Education so that you can't throw a bunch of additional items into them. But one way they've been able to pass those, however, is they've been spending more than even the budget caps, so-called budget caps, have said they could spend. That's the way they've gotten Democrats to come on board and the way they brought in some of the more moderate Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, the good news is they're doing a more of a normal budget process. The bad news is they're spending a lot of money to try and get that done. And I think as they go into what's called the reconciliation between the House and Senate bills, conservatives have to step up and say, we're going to have to bring back the bill numbers to more conservative figures to what we told people we were going to spend.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated.
It is complicated. And Genevieve, I'm a solid C student. And so when I ask questions, I really hope and pray that you speak at that level because I want to take a break. But when I come back, I'd like to ask you why Americans should care about the federal budget. I mean, you hear that it's $20 trillion, or if you look at what's unfunded, it's $100 trillion. And I go, I can't get my arms around those numbers, not even kind of. And why should we care, and what does it mean? So let me take a break. When I come back, we'll continue with Genevieve Wood from the Daily Signal. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on the studio line Genevieve Wood. She is with the Daily Signal, and usually we get Rob Bluey, but we have Genevieve today, and I hope we ask Rob Bluey back because Genevieve is amazing. She's great. We're all in the studio nodding our heads yes, but we love Rob. We love everyone at the Daily Signal.
I like Rob too.
Oh, no.
He's on vacation.
I know. I like to tease Rob because he's just so reliable and so good. You know, every time I hear Rob talk, I picture a big smile on his face.
Well, it's because he usually does have a smile on his face.
He's
serious about work, but he takes his job seriously, but not always himself seriously.
Yeah. And I can see you smiling, too, so that's good as well. So let's get back to this question I had about the federal budget. Now, for the average American, any ordinary American would think, okay, the federal budget is why should we care about it?
Well, because at the end of the day, bills come due, and eventually the bills that we're racking up will come due. We fight about a lot of different budget matters in this country, what we spend on education, what we spend on military, and so on. Everybody has their pet projects and projects that they don't like. But the reality is that the biggest trend lines, if you look at them, is what we're spending when it comes to known as entitlement programs. Some people don't like that term because they think they've paid into them, but that's being Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And if we don't reform these programs, it's not going to matter what we do in any other part of the government. It's not going to matter what we spend at the Defense Department. It's not going to matter what we spend on NASA or education. Those three programs are going to very soon, within the next 10 to 20 years, depending on which forecast you look at, they're going to take basically all the money coming into the federal treasury. And so at a certain point, you have to say, the gig's up. It's important that we grow the economy. We see that happening over this past year. You've seen a lot of growth. That's a good thing. But you can't grow yourself out of something when you're spending more than you take in.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, that's just the trend line that we're on.
Yeah. All right, Genevieve, let's think of the good news that we hear in the economy. Lately, it's been pretty positive. So
it has been.
Yeah, when we look at that, what can we expect? What should we be excited about? What should we be looking at going, this is good now, but?
Well, I think what we should be looking at is that people are not only are there jobs, there's more choice in jobs out there. Because the labor market is tightening, it means that employers are probably going to have to either pay their employees more or give them bonuses or additional benefits to keep them at their company, because if not, somebody else may try to hire them as well. So competition is good if you're an employee, because that means that if you're a good employee, there's a lot of demand for you right now. Mm-hmm. So that's one great benefit. But you know, one reason the economy is doing well, I think there's two big reasons. One, under President Trump, there's been a lot of deregulation going on, deregulation of laws and regulations that were on top of businesses and making it harder for them to run their business and making it more expensive. That's helped them, so a deregulated environment. But two, without a doubt, is the tax reform that went through. And what many people may not know is that the tax reform legislation is not permanent. It needs to be made permanent, but the law that was passed said we're going to do this for now, but it's not permanent. So if we don't pass more legislation that actually makes those tax cuts permanent, and you, let's say you had Democrats take control in November, what would happen? Well, Nancy Pelosi and others have already said what would happen is that they would reverse the tax reform measure. And that means all the incentives that businesses and individuals have had in terms of being able to hire more people, invest in their companies, which means they can hire more people or give bonuses to their employees, all of that goes away. So we're not out of the woods yet, so to speak. The tax cuts need to be made permanent, and we need to continue looking at regulations that can be rolled back so that the economy can move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not just good for businesses, it's good for individuals. We're seeing that.
Yeah, and absolutely. Genevieve, Britain has had a problem with last year's flu season, and I think of socialized medicine, and I go, you know, it's not good. And I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who recently had gone through a series of medical procedures, an operation, some treatments, and he was saying, well, you know, everyone should have access to good health care. And I go, I don't disagree. However, he was just telling me what he went through just cost. So to have a surgery and some treatments shouldn't cost $1.5 million, should it?
Hopefully not. No. I mean, I don't know exactly what surgery this is, but I'm trying to find one that should cost that. No.
But I mean, his surgery and all the treatment, I think his bill is like over $1.5 million already. So should...
And is he... go ahead. I'm
should
sorry.
Medicine cost that much? Isn't that part of the problem?
A big part of the problem is a distorted market. When you look at costs like that, you say, why would it cost something like that? I mean, I'm not saying that doctors and nurses and hospitals shouldn't charge what it takes, but the problem is we have a very distorted market,
mm-hmm.
and nobody really knows what this particular procedure or this particular drug or this particular doctor's visit actually costs. I mean, think about it. When you go to a doctor's office or you walk into a hospital, there's no posting up saying, here's what we charge for a flu visit. Here's what we charge for open heart surgery. Here's what we charge for this. No, all of those things are distorted prices behind. There's no transparency because we charge different people different things. And again, a lot of that's because the government is involved in the healthcare system at a far much higher level than it should be. And we don't make informed decisions and informed choices in our healthcare the way that we do in so many other sectors.
Mm-hmm. But Britain now they didn't do well with last year's flu season, and that's not good.
No.
Any comments on that?
Well, I mean, Britain, like many other countries around the world, their government is heavily involved in their healthcare system, and what happens is, you know, for example, last year they had a flu epidemic, which happens from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And to deal with it, what they ended up doing was saying, well, we have about 50,000 folks who have what they call non-urgent surgeries. Well, it's non-urgent, of course, unless it's you. and they just said, well, we're canceling those 50,000 surgeries so that we can deal with the flu epidemic. Now, if you're running a more private type of industry, chances are you'd hire more doctors, you'd hire more nurses, the quote-unquote free market would probably step in and expand services as opposed to saying, well, we just can't deal with those things. But in a socialized system as you have in Great Britain, where they're already underpaying, in many cases, medical professionals, doctors, nurses, hospitals and the like, it's very tough to expand a system, so you have to cut back. And in those cases, they, like I said, decided there were 50,000 folks who didn't need surgeries that were already scheduled just so they could deal with people coming in with the flu.
Mm-hmm. Genevieve, what's the prevailing mood in D.C. right now, especially before lunchtime?
Well, you know, the House of Representatives is not in town right now. They actually are on their recess.
Okay.
The Senate's coming back this week. You know, I think, as in many times in election year, a lot of people are wanting to kind of wait and see what happens. The difference in terms of the election, but the difference I think this time around is President Trump is a very active president, meaning he doesn't just kind of move from one thing week to week. I mean, every day there's something new, action happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's actually forced the congressional activity on the Hill to move at a little bit of a quicker pace, that they're kind of having to keep up. But I think that's a good thing, because I think we're getting more of our money's worth out of our elected officials. And so there's more activity than there often is, I would say, during an August period.
Yeah. Do you see more cooperation or more division going on right now?
Well, I would say if division, in the sense that both sides, as I said, are going to an election season, and so they're trying to kind of sharpen their position so that there's a more of a clear decision, hopefully, for the public. But, you know, I think this is one reason I hope that Republicans maintain control of Congress after November. While by no means are they perfect and are they getting everything done they need to get done, I think it's trending in the right direction. And I think much of the president's agenda that's been held up will actually be able to kick further in gear if the Congress remains in Republican control.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have been hedging their bets a bit, I think, because they have an election before them. Once that's passed, if Republicans are still in charge, I think you'll see more movement more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Genevieve, we just have like a minute left. What is the hottest story in your office today?
Wow, that's a good one. We've been talking a lot about the whole debate, especially among Democrats, on socialism versus capitalism.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw that poll that recently came out. Just because that shapes no matter what issue you're talking about, whether it's health care, whether it's taxes, the business environment, no matter what issue you're talking about, if you someone's worldview in terms of government's involvement in things versus people having more individual control and local control over decisions they make, that says a lot about where you go with those issues. Do you think the government should be running education and healthcare, or do you believe that those decisions related to those topics should be made closer to home? Your view on that changes how you vote, and it changes how we spend our money, and it changes how the country runs. So It's distressing to see a lot of Democrats thinking that socialism is a good idea, especially when you can't find, I don't think anywhere in the history, it's not like it hasn't been tried, where people can point and say, oh, yeah, that's working really well over there. But I think, you know, it's up to conservatives to make the case and show people why it's not the right way.
Yeah, Genevieve, I'm just delighted you were able to do the show. Thank you so much for coming out of the program.
And Thank you.
I would love to have you on again. And so we won't even tell Rob. We'll just get you on the show.
Would love to join you all again.
Thank you.
Next time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, Genevieve Wood has been my guest. She's senior contributor at the Daily Signal. We'll take a short break and be back with lots more in just a minute.
Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count. You know, spending time daily in God's Word is so very important. And Jay Dennis explains why.
If you're not allowing the Word of God to penetrate your heart and mind every single day, then it is so easy to get off track. Every day, it just seems like whether it's that New Testament or Old Testament passage, that Psalm or Proverb, the Holy Spirit daily speaks through His Word. If we miss that, we are going to miss God's greater plan for our life. Because those are the times when God has spoken to me the most clearly, is when that daily time of prayer and the Word and seeking Him.
Now that is something you don't want to miss out on in your faith walk. Do you want to learn more? Go to MakingYourLifeCount.com.
Welcome back to the show. I know it's always a difficult conversation when you are at the end of life of a loved one, and how do you experience the highest quality of life possible at the end of life? Because it's usually messy, complicated, and we don't sometimes know exactly how to care for our loved ones. And hospice care is always one of the most comforting places you can take and be with a loved one at that critical time of life. And I don't think anyone in the country does it better than NC Little, which is an 8-bed hospice in Edina, Minnesota. And I have, as a guest on our studio line, the director, Bob Solheim. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you this afternoon.
Thank you so much. You know, the natural and inevitability of the end of life, it's something we all face and everyone is going to go through. And it seems that hospice care enables families to just simply be families at that stage of life. Do I have that right?
Boy, you sure do. It's something that we hear from families almost every day, how grateful they are just to be able to sit at the bedside of their loved one and be daughter, husband, wife, family member, instead of having the responsibility of nurse.
Yeah, and when it comes to this stage, when they get moved into hospice care, usually what has led up to it has been extremely stressful, hasn't it?
Yes, in many cases, it's been a situation where they've been experiencing a whirlwind of clinic visits, maybe a trip to the emergency room or maybe multiple trips. And often we will find both patient and caregiver just physically and mentally exhausted.
Well, caregivers, especially when they get to this point, they're probably a little bit at wit's end, and they're afraid of losing their loved one, and they're anxious, and maybe there's been some issues with siblings. And so you are not only the director of the hospice, but you've got to wear all kinds of hats, don't you?
Yes, matter of fact, all of us here seem to do that. It's quite a place. What you say is so true. There's so many complexities involved with end-of-life issues, so many things that you sometimes hope that families draw closer together, but that's not necessarily the case.
Bob, when people are in hospice care, and how typically long is a hospice care stay?
Well, there's two concepts of hospice that we're tend to deal with on a daily basis. First is the home care, where nurses or doctors, social workers, grief support people may actually come into the person's home. A community is built around them of between 7 and 9 interdisciplinary people. That type of home hospice care in the United States has an average length of stay of about 59 days. And the median length of stay in home care is 21 days. What happens at little hospice is that symptoms have either gotten out of control, pain has escalated, or things have flared up to the point where they now need 24-hour skilled care, inpatient care. So when they come to the little hospice, almost everybody that comes here say, gosh, Bob, I guess we've come too late. They wish they would have come sooner, because our average length of stay here is 6 days, and our median length of stay is only 4. So it's a real crisis that we encounter with almost all of our patients.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bob, I know NC Little is host to everyone. Anyone that comes is welcome, and it's interesting because you are present for so much passing and so much people leaving this earth. And I'm thinking about the faith element and people that have no fear of death because they have a peace that transcends all understanding, which is not always the case with everyone.
No, it isn't. There's a real continuum. You take almost like a speedometer, and the person who has the closest relationship with Christ tends to, by and large, generally speaking, but it's my experience, they have the most peaceful death that you could possibly imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, when you come to the end of life without any faith, you only have yourself to cling to, and you're about to lose yourself, why, it's just the opposite. The anxiety levels, the pain, everything is more difficult to manage, and the psychological piece of dying for somebody without faith is just, it's a sad thing to witness.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, I know NC Little has been around since opening your doors in 1996. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you are probably now the longest serving residential hospice in the state of Minnesota. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair and true.
Now, yep. I know that there is hospice places, especially in the state of Minnesota, that have closed their doors recently. And I start to look at what makes for a successful operation. And I think you're going to use the word community in your answer. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, the community has really rallied around Little Hospice. We are so blessed. I cannot begin to tell you how grateful I am to the greater Edina area that's continually supports us. We're just blessed in so many ways.
Now, Bob, when you go to work every day, and I don't think you go 8 to 5 because that's not what the job calls for, because there is activity going on 24 hours a day, and you are aware of just about everything that goes on all the time. So talk, if you would, about how God will equip nurses and volunteers to serve with such passion in such a difficult environment.
Well, it's interesting because this is not a traditional nursing or other work-related environment at all. You need to be called to this kind of work. And if I've made a mistake in the hiring process and I hire somebody that isn't called, it just seems that they will work themselves out of this employment, because we have a death almost every single day here. And we're high touch and low tech in the sense that our nurses are encouraged to draw near to our patients, to give them foot massages, hand rubs, to sit at the bedside and pray with them if they like, and to provide these intimate cares that only end of life requires. And so you have to be a very balanced person. But if you're not faith-based, in my experience, as a nurse or other caregiver, it just isn't going to work for you long term. It just isn't.
When you are gathering around your loved one and you are spending those last precious days, are there certain rules, restrictions? How can the family best enjoy those last times together? Do the families eat at the Little Hospice, or what kind of hospitality goes on?
Sure. Well, we have a real family focus here. Families enjoy their meals, and we're talking about good stick-to-the-ribs, grandma types of meals. You probably had turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy rolls, butter dressing, dessert, things like that for Thanksgiving. Well, for us, that's Tuesday night. Wednesday may be ham. Thursday, baked chicken. We're trying to replicate as home-like an environment as we possibly can make it, to make this abnormal time as normal for people and less frightening and more bearable for patient and family member alike. And so for a family member to be able to just to sit, again, at the bedside of their loved one and to hold their hand and to talk to them, whether they're responsive or not responsive, or there is the ministry of presence, just being there. So often family members will say, gosh, Bob, I just don't know what to say to Aunt Emma. Well, you don't need to say anything. Just be there. Just be there. Hold her hand. Stroke her forehead. Just love her.
Mm-hmm. Bob, we're going to take a break here in a couple minutes, and then I want to hear some stories, if you can think of them. But obviously you've got lots of stories to tell. I don't know with what privilege you have to share some of them, but I know that there's been some amazingly poignant stories of people and their families at the end of life. But if you would, just because we'd love to hear a little bit of a background as to how you got into this this line of work.
Oh, sure. I had a dear friend named Newton Clendenin Little, who I met as a young married man in my early 20s, and he was already in his mid-60s. He and his wife had a print shop in South Minneapolis, and I was a young court reporter then, needed some print work prepared for me, and I met him, and a friendship developed that lasted his lifetime until his age 90, and he was a very godly, ethical, moral businessman, and I just learned so much from him about ethics and business and life, and he devoted his life to helping others, very Christ-centered. When it came time for him to die, his wife had already passed on, and she asked if I would help take care of Newt in his later years. I said I would, but he had a terminal illness that required 24-hour skilled care, and I had to place him in a nursing home the last 2 years of his life. And it was there that I read scripture to him daily, and I'd put him to sleep at night reading the Psalms, and then I would slip out of the room, and after 2 full years, he died of this difficult disease. And it was after that that I learned about the philosophy of hospice. I thought it was a plant or something prior to that. But I learned about it, and I thought, why couldn't you apply this to somebody's home? He desperately wanted to die in his own home, but that just wasn't meant to be. And so, fortuitously, an associate of mine worked at an end-of-life facility in South Minneapolis. It was called Midwest Community Hospice, and they needed a volunteer, and I reluctantly agreed to volunteer for 1 month, and that turned into 3 years. And it was during that time that I met a very talented nursing assistant that had just a lot of spirit and ideas. And together we thought, why couldn't we put together a residential facility that would provide good quality end-of-life care for people in a very loving, home-like fashion? And so we did. We embarked on what became almost a three-year adventure to be licensed with the Minnesota Department of Health as a residential hospice, the first one in the state, and the first 8-bed residential hospice in the state. And so that's sort of was the genesis of it. And since that time, we have now at Little Hospice cared for some 4,452 patients. So we've had a lot of activity.
You know, Bob, it's such an amazing story, and I love hearing it. And I'm thinking of the servanthood you had, this act of practicing the presence of God by simply going to Mr. Little's bedside and reading scripture to him at night and putting him and helping him get into bed and taking care of him like that. That it's so unselfish, and that's a word that we don't use very often anymore, because we get very consumed with our own life and our own day-to-day activities. And who can make that kind of sacrifice? Who can pay attention to that kind of detail for somebody? It's really quite remarkable.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
He became a lot like a father to me.
I bet he did. Years. Yeah. All right. I'm talking to Bob Solheim, director of NC Little Hospice. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to hear some stories in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on our studio line Bob Solheim. He's director of NC Little Hospice in Edina, Minnesota. It's a 9-bed hospice, 9-bed home for end of life, and an amazing facility opened in 1996 and has helped over 4,000 people transition from this life into the next. And, you know, every time you hear about the passing of someone, the first question is, was it peaceful? Was it sweet? And I know, Bob, you've been present in so many episodes of people dying, and I bet there's a story or two you might be able to share of some, end of life moments for people that are especially tender and sweet.
You know, there are really just so many that I could relate to you that have strengthened and deepened my faith and of those around me, that just serve as a reminder that the Lord can be with us and is with us at the end of life. And some seemingly miraculous things happen that we really hold close to our hearts. One that comes to mind was a young man that had three precious kids. They were just little ones, maybe 5, 8, and 10 years of age. And he was just a prince of a guy. He's with us for maybe 3 weeks, but it was over Easter one spring, and remember, his little girl was the oldest, and she just was her daddy. It was daddy's little girl, and she loved him so much, and dad wanted to do something special for them on Easter morning, and so we talked, and we were able to put together a really amazing Easter egg hunt with all kinds of nice toys for the kids and Easter eggs and Easter baskets. And we have a beautiful garden in the backyard. And we took a little bit of baking soda and flower, and we created little bunny tracks that the younger one could follow to find where some of the things were. And Dad, we brought him out on the deck so he could watch the kids having fun. And then we like to do some magic at the hospice sometimes, just some fun things. And so we had a little magic show, and Dad was able to help out. And it was a very joyous time. But I remember the little girl, as death drew near just a few short days later, she literally threw herself over her daddy's chest and just loved him until he drew his last breath. It was really very, very poignant, very poignant. I'll remember that a long time.
Very sweet. Oh, my. Those are such powerful images.
And we had a fellow who was an engineer, very bright, articulate guy. He was in his mid-70s, and his wife was somebody he'd been married to for about 50 years, and he just loved her with as much passion as a man could love a woman. And I remember that he sat at her bedside when she went unconscious or unresponsive, probably 1 week before death overtook her, and he would talk to her as if she were awake. And he continually professed his love for her. He never left her side. He was able to sleep in the room with her. We had a cot for him to lay right alongside of the bed. And it was a very interesting thing because even as her unresponsiveness became more severe in the sense that her body had modeled, her breathing had changed, and a lot of things had changed, and she had not spoken in a little over a week. I think it was 8 days that nothing was spoken, nothing by mouth, nothing by no food, obviously. And he was sitting next to her, and we had two nurses, one on either side, because as her breathing had changed, we knew that death was very, very imminent. And he said to her, "Ruby, I love you," something he'd been repeating over and over again. And this time, she sat up and she said, "I love you." And she laid down and died. There were no more breaths. That was it. And our nurses, it was really quite an impactful and even overwhelming experience. But it was truly the love of God present for that final gift. It was very special.
That's just beautiful, Bob.
The other one that comes to mind is this this very prominent physician that we had as a patient here. He was in his 80s now, and he was just a prince of a guy, very godly, would continually be reading scripture, loved to have a word of prayer. And while he was drawing closer to the end of his life, he too became responsive. But even before that, he was not able to walk. He was not. He had been in a wheelchair for many years. And then, again, after being unresponsive for several days, and not, wasn't able to eat, drink, sit up, do anything, he was just waiting to draw his last breath, our nurses checked on him, as they do frequently during the night, but it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and they had placed all four side rails up, which they always do on these hospital beds at the hour of sleep. And here, he had somehow gotten up out of bed and managed to draw himself down to the very foot of the bed, where they found him with his arms folded, his hands clasped together, and his head bowed, and he had died. He died on his knees, obviously, in prayer.
Wow.
An amazing thing. But then you can contrast it with a fellow that we had who just was... Well, it was so different that you almost felt like the presence of evil was in the room as he was cursing his wife and he was yelling at the nurses and screaming to everyone, get out of his way, leave him alone, and didn't want anybody to even be kind to him. It's even difficult to talk about.
I bet it is.
One of the few times in my life that I've ever felt the presence of true evil, and that's the way this poor guy died. Nothing could reach him. Nothing.
Oh, boy, it's that moment. Your heart is a wind-up clock, and it has so many ticks. When it takes that final tick, you then fall into the arms of your Heavenly Father, or you drop into a Christless abyss.
Amen.
And how important it is, and how critical it is at that precious time that you have, Bob, with these these patients and these families just to be modeling the love of Christ. It's just so powerful.
Well, it's a great privilege and honor, to say the least. And like I said earlier, it's an opportunity to really draw closer to God as you sit at the bedside of these dying saints.
Yeah, and I think one of the mottos is nobody should ever feel like they're dying alone.
No. We make that pledge to every patient and family that their loved one will not die alone in pain or with their symptoms unmanaged.
Mm-hmm. So how many years has it been now, Bob? I can't do the math.
We're in our 22nd year. We opened our doors December 1st of 1996.
And when you're doing what you've been doing for as long as you have, certainly you have seen a side of God's grace and mercy that the average person is never going to see.
Yes, I think you're right. It's an amazing thing.
As we kind of wrap up our time, I'm thinking of how so many people are against the idea of a natural death. You know, right now in our culture, there seems to be a lot of people wanting to have the idea of, you know, assisted suicide and everything else. And, you know, Ecclesiastes say there's a time to be born and a time to die. And we don't get to dictate that, do we?
No, we sure don't. Ecclesiastes says that God has established boundaries beyond which our life can't take us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love Psalm 139. As a matter of fact, our scriptures in the house are turned to that while we were knit in our mother's womb, God saw our unformed shape, and they were ordained for us all the days of our lives before one of them came to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good news. It's not totally in our control, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not. So, Bob, if there are listeners, I know there are today listening, that would say, you know, we're coming up on this situation, and we're coming up on needing to get a loved one into hospice care. Can you give them a little bit of encouragement about just how important it is and how wise it is and not to fear it?
Sure. One of the sad and tragic myths surrounding hospice is that it's a place where people go to give up, let go, and die. And it's just the contrary. It's a place where you go to live until you die. We celebrate life, not death. There's nothing joyful about death except that the person's going to be with the Lord. But the process, no, we celebrate life in hospice, and the earlier you enter a hospice, the longer you are likely to live, and the quality of your life will be dramatically better than if you don't go into hospice, and you would just receive better care, treatment, medications, medical equipment. Everything will improve for you if you have a terminal diagnosis with a life expectancy of 6 months or less to live.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, I know there's a lot of people that have an experience at the hospice that then want to return as a volunteer. You get a lot of that as well,
yeah.
Don't you?
We do. We have over 100 volunteers, and almost all of them at Little Hospice are former family members or close friends. Plus, at Little Hospice, we have some 30 registered nurses and 10 interdisciplinary staff. So
mm-hmm.
A lot of people to take care of 8 patients.
Yeah, and there's also a little bit of grief support. People can find places
yeah.
where they can have some follow-up afterwards as well.
It's interesting. In hospice, in order to be a hospice or be associated with it, you have to be able to provide both psychological, social, spiritual, and physical care for patients and their families.
I did not know that.
It's a family experience, yeah.
So you do it all and do it so beautifully. And if
Thank you.
Anyone wanted to investigate a little bit more on the Little Hospice, they'd go to littlehospice.org, littlehospice.org, and you can find out more about that location, of which there's only one. But Bob Solheim, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about this, difficult, heavy-hearted subject.
Thanks very much for having me.
You bet. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Yep, we'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.